Hi and welcome. This is Dave. How are you doing?
Good, Dave. How are you?
Great. I had a note that Kat may be delayed in joining us, but that she will be here at a later point. So let's check in. What kind of wins and progress notes do each of you have? Chris, I heard your bounding voice. What's going on, my man?
Well, I'm just kind of getting my head back together on. I've been up in Chicago Monday and Tuesday and buzz up there and back. So getting re-engaged today was a lot of fun. But I think you know I'm coaching one of the young guys in my office.
Yeah, how's that going?
It's actually going quite interesting, and I've thoroughly enjoyed this process because everything is following along with this. I mean, this is helping me out a lot because otherwise I'd feel kind of lost. But he's turned some corners, and I got to say, that's been real exciting.
Ah, that's great.
And that's been fun. Really
okay, well, super. Congratulations. That sounds great. If there's any aspect of it that you'd want to talk about or any challenges or best practices that you found, you know, feel free to jump in. That sounds great.
Well, I may email you or call you with some questions because I'm kind of getting deep into it now. And it seems like we keep bumping up against the same same thing. So I'll get with you offline on that.
Okay, let me know. Yeah. Who else?
Diane's here. How are you, Dave?
Welcome, Diane. How are you?
Doing okay. Thanks.
Great. Any progress notes?
You know what? I'm just getting it's interesting how I feel as if technology has really taken over with people, and so many people are just so over-the-top busy that I've just noticed their lack of awareness on big topics is just so limited. So that maybe as you get into the holidays, I'm not quite sure, but I've sort of noticed that the sense of being rushed and lack of awareness is it's bigger than I thought it was. So that's what I've been really paying attention to in the past couple of weeks.
Do you have an example of what's really crystallized that awareness for you?
Well, for instance, I was at a meeting last week on a college campus, and I am so surprised how many parents, intelligent parents, have swallowed this pill of, well, this is just how kids socialize now on their phones constantly. And I was like, well, maybe it's sort of like teaching manners. Maybe we really need to educate, you know, college students that they're there to connect with each other in person, not with, you know, their friends back home or down somewhere else. So I've just noticed more and more of that it is really a huge problem. And it's like a pill that everybody has just swallowed, like that's how it is type of thing. So, I'm feeling a little bit perturbed about it because no one seems to resist it at all or think that there's a way that we can bring some change to the situation. So,
interesting.
I don't know.
Do you have any ideas about how you want to address this?
Well, one of my suggestions was to have within an organization that it's kind of technology-free. For instance, if you go outside, take a hike, doing those types of things, because it seems as if the technology is in control of so many people, but I've gave the suggestion that perhaps we can sort of teach kids on campus how to be in control of their phone. There's a place for it, but it's almost like manners. You know, when you go to a movie, they tell you to shut your cell phone off. If I went to a lunch today and turn your cell phone off, all of that is perfectly acceptable because I think there's a place for it. Yet all over college campuses, one of the reasons I expect my children to be socializing and having FaceTime, you know, with their colleagues, and the biggest complaint is the fact that everyone is literally, they're getting hit by buses, they're running into bikers, they're so glued to their phone, that face time and that just normal exchanging in a college environment is really diminishing. So I addressed it as something that I think we should bring forward, teaching kids, you know, within that environment how to be successful. You know, I brought it up to an advisory committee for the whole school, and some people thought it was a good idea, but some parents just were glazed over, like, that's just how it is. And I was kind of, you know, so, yeah, I mean, within my own environment, I discussed it with my daughter at her school, you know, and yes, within certain things that she's doing, they have decided they need to address it very clearly because it's just becoming such a problem that in the environment that everyone's in, nobody is really connecting with what's going on. They're taking pictures of events to send it instead of being in the moment. You know.
Now, this wouldn't be Yale, would it, or is it a college in New Canaan?
No, she actually goes to Loyola Marymount in L.A.
I see. Oh, wow. Uh-huh.
I have
okay.
a child in Philadelphia, so I'm kind of on a board
over
there.
That's right. all over the place. Okay.
Diane, this is kind of interesting. I spoke on something similar to this a few months ago to a large group of real estate people in Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
Our business, and I think it's not just our business, it's just as a whole, that kids have so much more access to information that it floods them. So what you were talking about earlier, however, things seems like it's just going faster and faster. It's because part of it is because there's so much information available. It's all accessible at an instant's notice. So what I was speaking on was that this is the time in everyone's life where they may be depending upon their devices for information, but yet the time when we need each other and the human contact is more important because that interaction helps you understand and kind of disseminate and understand this massive amount of information. We grew apart from each other when we started getting access to it. Now we're kind of growing back together as to help process and understand the information. Anyway.
That's an interesting comment about the evolution of it. That's really interesting.
Oh, I think we're really on a I think we'll look back in history about everything that we're doing wrong. So I think that there is, you know, like many things, we need a new norm. Yet there's, I think, many social issues that are being created because there's a perception of being connected. But they're really losing a lot of the face time that they have access to at a really important time in life. And I think the relationships are deteriorating. I mean, potentially, there's a great opportunity for coaching, actually, because I think they're addicted. I think it's an addiction that people are just swallowing without realizing really how toxic it is. You know, it's the same as food. I mean, I went to a lecture today, which was so interesting, but about how you know, so much of cancer, for instance, is preventable with healthy exercise, deep breathing, proper food selection, et cetera. But it goes back to the same point, which is if you don't slow down and make decisions and evaluate what you need to do to become successful and balanced, you won't be. So there's this, you know, or I don't know if it's just here because it's very intense, you know, in this little triangle that I am, but the awareness on so many things is diminished, as well as people's intelligence, applying their intelligence to everyday situations. It's disturbing because you're almost talking on deaf ears. People are not even aware because they are literally hooked to their phones. Like, you know, they really are.
You know, listen to what you think about what our topic is today about states of mind, because there's definitely some thought about the Internet and the way that we get into a zone on the Internet being state-changing and being a kind of regulation of state of mind that we get hooked into a state being on the Internet. I mean, you know, back when the internet first came about, I treated one of the first internet addictions of anyone around, someone who was compulsively shopping and spending about $10,000 a month on the internet and just, you know, couldn't quite let go of it until she came for treatment, because it was state-changing and it was something that she could zone out, and she really used it very much like a drug. So, it, you know, being on the internet, being on Facebook, it is state-changing, and there's a compelling quality to it. So think about what you hear about state of mind as we talk about that today, that that may apply to what you're saying. And Diane, while we're talking, would you want to do your roadmap either January 8th or January the 15th? You're the one I haven't signed up for a date yet. So those two dates are open, week 10 and week 11, January 8th and 15th. Do you want to pick one?
You know what? Either is fine, to tell you the truth. I mean,
What do you prefer?
Push it out because I will have a house full of college kids, but you know what?
You want to do it on the 11th instead of the 10th week then, January 15th?
The 11th. What? I think I'll
January 15th, week 11.
Oh, okay. That's fine. Yes.
Okay. You're down. Okay, great. Is Lynn here? Okay. Any things that have come up in your work or in the reading that have been challenges or things you'd like us to talk about before moving into the material? Oh, I didn't give you my progress note. This is a progress note to indicate how very portable this whole business of being a professional coach is. I am, for the month of November, as I mentioned to you, in a Creole, a refurbished Creole cottage, a house in the French Quarter in New Orleans, and completing a book. And I'm still obviously doing the training and calls and that sort of thing, but it's a totally different experience, a terrific time, and it works very well, and it's really a testament to how portable the business of coaching is. So, Chris, you can work from your beach house. There's no reason you have to go back to Dallas on Sunday nights anymore once you get established.
I love that idea.
Yeah.
I have with you that I went to college in New Orleans, so.
Oh, which one?
Loyola.
Oh, yeah, okay. I just had a drink last night with a basketball player from Loyola from several years ago. Interesting, yeah.
It's a great city. It's so fun.
Oh, yeah.
A bit it's at the moment. I really enjoyed it. It's great food, great music.
When I was in medical school here, I would jog in the quarter and kind of look back and wonder what was in those courtyards and what it would be like, you know, just to walk back to see how people lived here. And now I've been able to do it and be in a number of residences and visiting neighbors and stuff. So it really is a treat in a number of ways.
That's great.
Anything else to discuss or anything else you want to bring up before we get into the material?
I don't know, my friend. I mean, a lot of this resonated with me because, I mean, I feel comfortable with constantly assessing where I am emotionally and challenging myself throughout the day, you know, to make sure where my center is. A lot of this was familiar to me, although I hadn't seen it put as clear as it is in the book.
Well, I really think that mastering states of mind, regulating states of mind and emotion is a key success strategy and is one of the major things that that I see, whether it's a CEO, whether it's an athlete. The talent, the ability, the capacity for someone to become a CEO or to become a pro athlete or to become a professional, there's not a question about their ability, their talent, the smarts to get to where they are. But it's what they do with it at that point, how they regulate states of mind, how they deal with especially success. You know, people have got screwing up down. They've got failure down. That's not hard to adjust to. And dealing, though, with remarkable success is a particular challenge. And there's all, and we'll get into this, and I'll give you some examples of this. But So let's start. Imagine, close your eyes now, and imagine you're at an auction. The room is filled with 75 sophisticated-looking people in business attire. The auctioneer walks in and holds up a $100 bill before your group. He explains the auction scenario. Bids move in $5 increments. The highest bidder wins the bill. The second highest bidder pays the bid, but gets nothing in return. And he reminds, this is real money. Now, within seconds, the bids pass $100. Some of the 75 people push the bidding up past $300. Two of the people get in a bidding war. One of them ends up writing a check for $460 and gets nothing. And the winner of the auction, in quotes, pays $465 for the $100 bill. Now, how could reasonable people pay more for something that it's worth? Actually, this scenario has already happened. It's happened more than 600 times. The auctioneer, Professor Max Bazerman. The setting, Harvard JFK School of Government. The participants, investment specialists and economic gurus, not students, not graduate students, investment specialists and economic gurus. Some of the brightest financial experts consistently pay 3 to 4 times the worth of the $100 bill just because of the way their minds work. Now, this isn't a stock that its value depends on what someone is willing to bid, you know, because the stock market isn't really a market. It's an auction because the value depends on what somebody's willing to bid at a particular moment in time. This is $100. It's set. Professor Bazerman commented, I've never seen bidding stop below $100 in any of the more than 600 times I've done it. And I've done a keynote a couple of times where on two occasions I've had someone approach me after the keynote and said, you know, Dave, I was in one of those auctions, and that's exactly how it happened. And they described exactly what I had read about Bazerman doing that auction. Neither one would admit where they dropped off bidding, but neither one of them wrote a check. So what happened? What mind matters and brain business secrets are hiding in the open? Well, here's some of what we know. Some contributions first from the mind. Loss aversion. I'm not going to be the second highest bidder, still pay and get nothing. Studies show that losing $100 makes us twice as unhappy as gaining $100 makes us happy. We have a significant aversion to loss. Sunk cost fallacy. Well, I've already bid $260. I'll just go $10 higher. We justify continuing because of what we've already put into it. And I can't tell you the number of times that I've commented on an advisory board or a board of directors when people get into segmented thinking like this, that I'll just go $10 higher. They look at a decision and the increment of expense is focused on, well, this is just X amount more. We couldn't actually decide not to do it. And what's lost in this, you know, I've already bid $260, I'll just go $10 higher. It's like they're spending $10, but what gets lost is that they actually are spending $270 for a $100 bill, not just that increment of $10. This is the kind of segmentation that people often engage in with credit card purchases. They totally forget or don't tally up the ongoing, the cumulative amount of money spent, but it's this amount, and especially if there's an anchor that this that I'm buying for $40 was originally marked at $89, it's like I'm saving $49 because, of course, that's not what happens. You don't save $49. You spend $40, and that adds to the already accumulated amount that you've already spent. Now, here's some contributions from the brain. The prefrontal cortex says stop at $95. The limbic system says, I'm excited, I'm going to win, I can't stop now. Our states of mind are vulnerable to emotional contagion. In that auction room, brains were on a collective tilt. The herd mentality was running wild. But here's the conversation even without the contagion. The prefrontal cortex says, let's save for retirement. The limbic system says, let's go ahead and buy that 27-inch iMac and have a second cognac. Money behavior and financial decisions are sometimes, rarely, actually about money. If money were about math, no one would have at least personal debt. And $100 would simply be $100 instead of another number based on another state of mind. Here's one more brief scenario about how tilt can be contagious. 433 people voted on a proposal. It failed. If only 12 of those 433 people had voted yes instead of no, the outcome would have been exactly the opposite. The result? In the next 5 hours, the stock market lost $1.2 trillion. Here's what one senior equity trader on Wall Street said. You just felt like the world was unraveling. People started to sell, and they sold hard. It didn't matter what you had, you sold. This collective tilt shows how states of mind are vulnerable to emotional contagion. This vote on the mortgage bailout in late 2008 crystallized an entire economic scenario of events. Chuck Prince, the then head of Citigroup, said, as long as the music is playing, you got to get up and dance. This is a senior executive who verifies herd mentality and seemingly endorses it. Greed, emotional contagion, and peer pressure all can trump logic. When you see friends, for example, making significant profits trading stock or flipping real estate, the natural inclination is to want in on the action. As more join the movement, prices rise for a while, and it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. But then some event reverses the momentum, bursts the bubble, and turns optimism into panic. Chris, I bet you have seen this numerous times and in numerous ways over your professional lifetime.
Oh, yeah.
Go ahead, sorry.
We even saw it at the estate sale.
Oh, yeah. right. Herd mentality pushes people to join the momentum to buy or to flee the market and sell. And people aren't stupid. They're just not regulated. They make mistakes. They buy low and sell high, either because they don't have a plan or they don't stick to it when emotion vaults beyond the fence of that plan. Even when they're finance or economic experts, they pay $350 for a $100 bill or over $6 for a stock they know is worth $3 twice in a row. And they don't suddenly get smart the third round. They learn to regulate. Another example, Google announced its financial results for the fourth quarter of 2005 on January 31st, 2006. Revenues were up 97%. Net profit up 82%. Phenomenal growth. Yet Wall Street analysts had predicted even better. The actual growth per share was 1 penny less than analysts predicted. As a result, Google stock lost $22.3 billion in value in a matter of minutes before trading was halted. Nothing of the underlying company had changed. The phenomenal growth was still there. But the mindset of investors had changed just on the basis of one event that was state-changing. The great investment analyst Benjamin Graham was asked what it takes to be a successful investor. His response, people don't need extraordinary insight or intelligence. What they need most is the character to adopt simple rules and stick to them. Bazerman's auction is an example of creating a bubble. And bubbles are simply a market phenomenon in which value is inflated significantly beyond its basic worth. A collective tilt. A group mentality state of mind. So let's talk about regulating states of mind. And because I think this is really crucial in coaching. A state of mind is a mind-body state, like a specific software program that determines how we perceive and how we process information, and then how we respond. A state of mind is a set of particular emotions, memories, mental models, and actually entire behavior patterns. A key element of coaching is to help a client become aware of various states of mind, with particular focus on which state works best for what purpose. Clients may move from a state of mind where they feel stuck or myopic to one of seeing possibilities, to a state where the scope and range of thinking and possibility is much broader. Here's an illustration of how states of mind are like different software packages. If you take a rat and put it in a maze and teach it to get to the cheese, it can go again and again. Now, if before you put the rat into the maze to teach it to get to the cheese, you inject it with just a little bit of amphetamine. In other words, you alter its state to simulate a slight stress state. You teach it to get to the cheese, it can go again and again. Now, you take away the amphetamine, and the rat can't get to the cheese. It has in a part of its brain the information about how to get to that cheese, but it can't access it, and the rat can literally die of starvation in that maze, not being able to access the information. You re-inject the amphetamine, the rat immediately goes to the cheese. State-specific learning, state-dependent memory. So a model of state of mind and regulation of states is, in another perspective, the infant child, or the infant-adult interaction. In any one moment, the infant's totally in a particular state, contentment, upset, hunger, pain. The adult empathically resonates with this state in order to lend the function of regulation until the infant's soothed. With time, as infants develop, they learn to moderate these all-or-nothing states of mind to be able to internally regulate. This attachment and borrowed regulation is gradually internalized so that ultimately they self-regulate. This is the analog, the foundation of collaboration and contingency among adults and among mentor coaches with clients. We engage in collaborative conversations with our clients and help them both understand and regulate states of mind. So coaching needs to be both heart-based and brain-based for this balanced learning and growth. We now know that this collaborative communication and empathic connection creates new neural connections. So I want to talk about a mentor coaching application. And again, stop me at any point if you want to discuss or elaborate or talk about it in any way. It's important for the mentor coach to enter into and hold the mind-body state of the client to understand the subjective experience as well as the story communicated by the client. Developmentally, the right brain communicates emotionally before the verbal linguistic abilities of the left brain mature. Most of the interactions in a relationship are outside conscious awareness in a right brain to right brain communication of emotional states of coaching client, actually more in a midbrain to midbrain kind of connection and conversation. The mentor coach must remain open to receiving communication from the client's right brain and midbrain to become attuned to the state of mind of the client. This precedes planning and synthesizing. So once the mentor coach is tuned into the client, the coach can receive and resonate with communication in all forms, not just verbal. They together can then explore experiences, possibilities, brainstorm, and plan. This resonance can also creatively transform the experience into new ideas, co-creations, beyond where either might go alone. So, what this means in one sense, then, is the mentor coach, as mentor coach, we need to allow this right brain engagement of taking in emotional communication to hold unexplained experiences, feelings, and ideas until a recognizable pattern emerges. This requires deep listening and attention simultaneously at multiple levels. It's a way of thinking and a way of experiencing combined. It's the art and science of mentor coaching. Now, a bit about the neuroscience of decision and conflict. You see a car swerving into your lane, headed directly for you. In a matter of seconds, your life could be over. As soon as you perceive the danger, you reflexively hit the brake pedal and horn and sharply turn the steering wheel. In a matter of seconds, your physiology has changed. You're exhausted, short of breath, heart racing. Emotional chemicals triggered by an automatic alarm reaction instantly change your state of mind to one of survival. Each thought and feeling has a chemical consequence, not cause now, but consequence. The chemicals of emotion alter mind and body. Personal experience determines what software program, in other words, what state of mind, to use to process the data and how to respond. When the incoming data resembles threat or danger, as in this example, it instantly triggers an emotional and biochemical response within just a fraction of a second. These chemicals of this emotional state necessarily hijack the logical, rational brain, which is a natural survival response. You don't want to be cognitively processing, thinking about the options. You need to respond instinctively. But emotion-based states where rational ones need to prevail may use information unhelpfully. In other words, in a different context, this automatic alarm system may cause mistaken perception and judgment if you're responding stressfully to a professional matter, for example, and need to have that balance. A hot stock tip, a business deal gone sour, family tragedy, any or all of these may create an alarm response and an emotional state of mind geared for survival rather than use of logic. Or, consider this too, if the mentor coach remains in a logical, intellectual frame of mind, a necessary empathic resonance to connect with a client's emotional experience may be missed. Neuroscientists use functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRIs, to study the response and functioning of the brain to various stimuli. These studies and their findings can be used to help us understand how to help our clients make decisions that are in their long-term best interest. And just a few of these, some examples of how at times, for example, logic takes a back seat in financial decision-making. Brain scans show that when people feel they're being treated unfairly, a portion of the midbrain called the anterior insula lights up and overwhelms the logical considerations of the prefrontal cortex. This is the same kind of disgust that people have, for example, when they encounter a rotten apple. Another example, making an example of people like Ken Lay and the prosecution of other executives for their crimes doesn't work and will not work. If it were sufficient, Ponzi would have been the last to teach us this lesson. To make an example is an abstraction. That's not how the emotional brain works. When something bad happens to someone we envy, the result is that we often paradoxically feel good. In fact, neuroscientists at the University of Cambridge found that news of the downfall of the rich and famous activates the dorsal anterior cingulate cortex of the brain. Their humiliation activates this region of the brain that responds to conflict and social rejection. In fact, the study showed that the more we envy someone, the greater the pleasure at his or her downfall. So this can account for our pleasure in seeing a high-powered CEO who earned several millions in bonus get humiliated in front of a congressional committee exposing indiscretion or doing the perp walk. And think about it. When Bernie Madoff got shoved on the sidewalk, be honest, how many times did you rewind? Actually, you probably didn't have to rewind because CNN did it several times for you right there. Another example, shopping can change the way you feel. It can be state-changing. And remember, it's the anticipation of an event, such as spending money, that is state-changing. It doesn't take the event itself. When people feel insecure, either emotionally or economically, they reassure themselves by shopping. For the most expensive shops on Madison Avenue, one of their best days in history was the day Lehman Brothers failed. Also, brain scan shows that the pleasure center, the nucleus accumbens, lights up when people consider a purchase. The insula, the brain structure activated by pain, lights up when someone thinks about the cost, and especially when they have to make payment. Usually, these balance out, so we look at the pleasure of the purchase and the cost, including the emotional cost, and make a rational decision. Now, both of these brain areas, the pleasure center and the pain center, compete with each other to determine whether or not we'll buy something. The pleasure center wins hands down when you segment the purchase from the payment, such as with the use of a charge card. So, Chris, you got to have a charge card running for those garage sales from now on.
Well, I will. Hey.
The pain of payment is relegated to a theory, an abstraction, because it's seen as a future event. Well, I'll take care of it next month. And then our optimism bias and other aspects come into play. Well, I'll probably have more money next month. So it's an abstraction that causes no present pain, which is one of the reasons, probably a central reason, that people purchase on the average 23% more when they do it by charge card than when they pay cash or write a check. Now, let's look a bit at choice enhancements. So these are some consideration to apply to emotions and choices. Increased tension produces emotional regression. Now, what that means is with increased tension or conflict, the stress response action can move somebody into an emotional pattern or characteristic of a much earlier age. Let me give you an example through an illustration through these instances. An executive, a very savvy executive woman, I was working with on the West Coast, made a statement like this, which is an indication of how increased tension produces emotional regression. She said, "I must be doing something wrong. All the things I know to do aren't working." And when we looked at that, the age of that conversation was mid-adolescence for her. She had slid back to a time when she felt like because of some particular stress that she was under, that everything she was doing and trying to do wasn't working, and that was exactly her state of mind at a particular time period during her mid-adolescence. So it produced emotional regression to that time because it was queued up by a similar kind of stress. 2, increased emotion narrows perspective. And here's how she put that. "I'm so preoccupied with my portfolio losing value, it's hard to focus on my work." So when emotion prevails, focus becomes narrower and more restricted to the most recent event, the recency effect. There's more emotional salience of something that happened just recently. It's more in the foreground. Paradoxically now, and this is important, paradoxically, attempting to use reason and logic when someone's escalated in a highly emotional state, it deepens that automatic alarm pattern. So the escalated person is going to further escalate, dig in their toes, and spiral into more extreme responses and hurl themselves away from logic. And this is one of the reasons, and you'll hear me repeatedly say, state always comes first, then strategy, and then story. We have to deal with the state first to empathically resonate with someone's state of mind. That creates a common ground together that we can proceed to a new place. So, 3, when you're in a state of upset, the first order of business is to regulate feelings. State always comes first. To restore a cool, a balanced state. So when you're relaxed and centered, you have the greatest access to all of your states of mind, all the information you possess. Now, a couple of other sort of practical considerations is to lump tasks, according to states of mind required to do them. It takes energy to change a state of mind. So clustering similar tasks that require the same state of mind is an efficient strategy. For example, if there are some chores that you have to do, some things that errands that you have to do during the day, it's most efficient in most cases to cluster those errands to be all in the same time rather than seeing a client doing an errand, seeing a client doing an errand, because if you sustain a state that requires a similar state of mind, it's a much more efficient strategy. You know, it's been said that turning on a TV takes the same amount of energy as it does to run a TV for about the next 3 hours. And it's similar with state changes. If you engage in state changes, you'll end up depleting and feeling more exhausted. You probably have the experience, you know, I certainly do, when I do a keynote or a retreat for a sustained period of time, I'm working at sustaining a particular state of alertness and crispness, and then at the end of that time, I realize that I'm tired because it's taken a lot of energy to really be in that state. And another aspect that I think is helpful is to learn the optimum state of mind for a particular task. You know, for example, creative writing and editing use two different parts of the brain, two different states of mind, so it's useful to do one and sustain that, not to go back and forth. And to protect your time for an endeavor of a particular state of mind. In other words, time that you decided to immerse yourself in work and concentrate on something, to protect that time and not have it interrupted by telephone or by people dropping by, but to really organize that, structure it so that you can sustain that focus for the period of time you've decided. Now, I want to look at a practical application here about regulating states of mind. I want to give you just a brief vignette of a guy I worked with. I'm going to call him Jim. He was the COO when we started working together, Chief Operating Officer of a large healthcare company in a major U.S. city when we first started working together. As a result of our work together for a few months, he decided to toss his hat in the ring for a CEO position. He had some great offers, and we crafted a terrific compensation package. Now, as soon as he took over the new company, it was already in the process of negotiation for a joint venture with another company. The other company's CEO, I'm going to call him Tom, were into negotiations with a joint venture, and Jim had to get very involved very quickly. And he said, you know, look, I'm more myself than I've ever been. I'm way beyond what I've imagined, but this one I just can't get my arms around. When Tom gets on his soapbox and explains simple things to me like he would to a novice, I overreact. I want to tell him off. It feels like a put-down. And I said, I understand how when you take it personally, it bruises your pride. What ideally would you like to do? He said, well, I have to think and not react, but I get sucked in even when I know what not to do. He just sets me off in a way, the way he talks down to me, like he knows it all. It's like I can't not respond. I need a strategy. So Jim recognized that this reactive mode departed a state of mind where he could reason and negotiate strategically. And I asked, what can you do and still be yourself and be effective in those instances when you feel personally insulted? He said, well, I have to think and not react. I have to let him finish his points and get the emotion out of it for me. So he was saying, in effect, that he needed to regulate his state of mind and manage his emotions in order to be effective. So what I had him do was to suggest that he take the four-column approach, the neuroconditioning work page, and put the cues, the emotional triggers, in the first column of all the things that Tom did that set him off, and to couple that with exactly, specifically, how did he respond for each of those cues. And then for the third column, to plan how he would get centered and grounded, to develop a mantra of getting centered and grounded, and then what his ideal response would be, to have all that pre-planned before he ever went into the conference room. And the principles that we discussed in his doing this were first to not take it personally, to see it objectively so that he could really look at his responses and those four columns of responses. And the principle here is everyone is always making self-statements. Tom was showing Jim exactly what it was like to be him. Jim came to recognize this and recognize that he was taking personally the behavior that he then came to see Tom had that same behavior with other people. And I asked Jim how he understood Tom responding in the way that he did so that he finally could reflect, well, he probably feels threatened or insecure at the time he gets on his soapbox and lectures. Another aspect to recognize the early warning signs of emotional triggers and response patterns. That was the first column, to really be aware of all the cues, the subtleties, the nuances, so that he could know exactly how he responded in order to have a different plan, a way to get grounded and an ideal response. And I also suggested, especially since this was new and he didn't have, you know, a month or so to have this four-column approach create a default mode so that he could automatically operate in it, he was needing to negotiate on a daily basis. So I suggested that in addition to doing this four-column approach, that he write down his responses while Tom was talking so that he could plan out his strategy of response. He could then review what he was going to say to make it objective and reasoned, in other words, to restore left brain logic. And a serendipitous result was that Tom noticed that Jim was writing down everything he said, so he was flattered. He thought he wanted to get every word down. So finally, when Tom finished, he could make his points or statement from a very strategic and a very thought-out way to do this. And when Jim stayed in the logical part of his brain, he did great. His regulation of state of mind allowed him to sustain effectiveness rather than get emotionally derailed. Later, as he was looking back on this sequence and scenario, he said, you know, I think I understand Tom and me better. I have an easier time of it with every encounter now with guys like him, now that I have this method. So let's look practically now at how to regulate states of mind. The most important thing we can do to achieve success, I believe, is to manage our emotions and regulate our state of mind. What do these people have in common? John Belushi, Marilyn Monroe, Elvis Presley, Janis Joplin, F. Scott Fitzgerald. They never learned the crucial strategy of managing their states of mind. Using drugs, alcohol, or some other addictive substance or a process to regulate a state of mind and manage emotion leads to significant compromise. Your state of mind, the particular software program you use, determines the meaning you attach to a stimulus. The meaning you attach then determines your behavior. There are two primary ways to regulate your state of mind: physiology and focus. Physiology is how you use your body, and that can be done simply by focusing on deep breathing to breathe in relaxation and breathe out tension. And focus is what and how you focus on. This can be done by a simple phrase that can allow you to focus in a specific way that gets you into this mode of being very balanced and centered. And I'm going to refer you to the blog that I have on developing a mantra. And there's an example there that I won't take time to go into, but it's, I think, the second or third down in the archives, if you haven't looked at that before. It's a way to combine a cue, such as something just to remind you to do the focus and the physiology. The focus is a specific phrase that you say, and because the focus determines what state of mind you're going to be in and determines where you you focus your attention and energy, and the physiology of deep breathing. Mine, when I do a keynote or get ready to, you know, to do a retreat, I do a simple cue of putting my index finger and my thumb together on both hands and putting them together to form a little infinity sign. I can do that invisible to anyone else below a conference table or in my lap, coupled with a deep breath of breathing in relaxation, breathing out tension, and whatever I need to get into a state of mind for. If it's a presentation, it's relaxed and powerful. So I'm primed for the state that I need to be in for optimum performance. And that takes about 3 or 4 seconds to automatically create a state of mind that is synchronous with exactly the task that you have at hand. So these are things that, now, does this make sense to each of you? Does this make sense in terms of getting into a state of mind and cueing that for an optimum endeavor or performance?
Oh, absolutely. It is just, I think, finding one that effectively works and
uh-huh.
just repeats.
Yeah, and different ones may work for different situations because, you know, to get in an optimum state of performance, like for a keynote, is different than getting into a state of relaxation when you're about to go to sleep. So you'll want something that, you know, that really works for that. In fact, there's some very recent neuroscience studies that have shown that actively repeating a certain phrase like peace can activate genes that suppress the stress response. And that repeating a focus on negative words inhibit this suppression so that there's more free rein of a stress response. It actually has an epigenetic effect. It affects gene expression that has to do with immune and stress responses. So pretty amazing stuff. You know, another application that I wanted to mention in terms of focus, when you think about it, we're always asking ourselves questions. You know, the question of what does this mean? What should I do? Think about times, and this came up for me the first time when I was doing a guest presentation at a Vistage group, you know, the group of CEOs. And they invited me to do a presentation on state of mind and management because two of the members at their companies had really, really upsetting things happen at their company, at their site. And there were quite different events, but each had been a preoccupying focus, especially for the CEO and CEOs and the business owners. So they were actually still, weeks and weeks later, still undergoing stress, not being able to sleep. And they each of the members had something similar, or at least analogous, that they could appreciate this. So they wanted to know how to do better regulation of stress management. And one thing that I suggest, the thing that I suggested that of all the things in the understanding and the strategy and all, that they reported later had the most impact was, think about how we always ask ourselves questions. At the minute we wake up, we're asking ourselves questions whether or not we're consciously aware of it. And especially if something is preoccupying or going wrong, it's like, man, what's going to go wrong today? Or, you know, how's that going to turn out? I wonder if some disaster scenario is going to come from that meeting. You know, you begin to think about those things that are preoccupying first thing when you wake up. So what I recommended that each of the members of the group do, and emphasizing this focus, was before they went to bed, write down 3 questions that were empowering. Things that when they thought about the answer to the question, it would be an empowering and state-changing kind of question and response. Now, like, for example, what will I create today that will be more powerful than I ever dreamed of? And have fun doing it. Because your brain follows your focus. So when they wrote down three questions that would create an empowered state of mind. I suggested that they put them by their bedside, and immediately when they wake up, before they're even fully awake, as soon as they turn on their bedside lamp, that they go over these three questions and answer them for that moment, for that day. And they found that that set a state of mind in motion that lasted for several hours to the rest of the day. Because, you know, think about whenever you have something preoccupied, or just when you get up and you stub your toe, and you're instantly in a bad mood, and that you know, creates a crescendo effect. That focus perpetuates itself. So when that focus is orchestrated, it can be very powerful, because remember, you're already asking questions. This just changes the focus to consciously engineer those questions that empower you. Any thoughts or questions?
Dave, can you go over what was the question again that you asked again?
Okay, well, I give an example, but I emphasize this is only an example so that people will create their own questions. I give an example of, I said something like, what will I create today that will be more powerful than I ever dreamed of, and have fun doing it? Let me give you the example from the blog, and this is to give an example of the focus. When Southern Utah University's new basketball coach Robert Reed arrived, his team ranked 217th in free throw percentage. That was the lowest in their division nationwide. So during practice, Reed has players develop a mantra before each free shot. He suggested that they cue that by dribbling twice and have a three or four word phrase. And he gave the example of relaxed and smooth. But he emphasized that when they stepped up to the free throw line, that they each have their own phrase, their own focus and words, so that it really be theirs. And then combined with a deep breath, breathe in relaxation, and breathe out tension. So they had this three-part mantra, the cue, the focus, and the physiology. And he also simulated game conditions because when they were working out, he would blow the whistle, have them go to the free shot line. Because that's really the way it works in a game. You don't, in a game, get to line up and shoot 30 free shots and get to count your best. Additionally, there's the stimulation of the home and the away crowd. So when they missed, they had to run four laps. When they made it, they got to have a breather. In 2 years, the team was ranked number one in their division nationwide. So mantras and the questions just cue a state of mind that fit for a particular circumstance to get grounded and centered for an optimum performance. So does that answer your question about the focus and about questions that can be empowering or fit for a particular circumstance?
Yes, it does.
Okay, all right, great. Now, let me give you one other example of a case, because I've heard that, I know that you're each wanting more actual case examples and application. This is an application of this with a client who was a CPA, and he actually had, as we came to find out in beginning to work together, that he had attention deficit, he had ADD. Now, he would function brilliantly when he focused and became immersed on a specific task. But his challenge was twofold. When there were external distractions, he got derailed and had trouble moving from task to task and project to project in a day that he could optimize each of the segments in a way that he needed. So for him, and he initially consulted me because he wanted to take his local CPA firm national and develop a structure for a partnership strategy and to really go into a national arena and needed to have strategy around that. Plus, he needed to function in a very different way to begin to be more of a CEO of an organization than, you know, the chief CPA. So for him, self-regulation involved establishing an entire daily schedule so that he had a map for the day and he could readily look at where he was. So for his situation, and especially since he, you know, had difficulty sustaining attention, but when he got immersed in something, he had powerful concentration. It was just that he easily got distracted. So I suggested that he create a weekly schedule and then a daily schedule that was very detailed. I knew he worked at an IMAX, so I suggested that he put his daily schedule hour by hour on a post-it note to the left of his screen, and that each hour he would write a new post-it note and put it to the right of his screen so that he had always, at an immediate glance, what his next best action was, what his task was for that hour that he was going to be immersed in. So for his daily schedule, he learned then to schedule blocks of uninterrupted time to sustain a state of mind. He also learned to structure participation by his office assistant to not have interruptions by telephone. He didn't have to unplug his phone. He just said no calls to his assistant and had no people drop by unexpectedly at particular times. But she would schedule all the calls at a particular time, all the curbside consults at a particular time, so he could sustain a particular state of mind for each of those tasks. So he also learned and paid attention more to his biorhythms, the best time of the day for him to do certain tasks, like for him, creative time early in the morning, and to really protect those times and to cluster the activities that required the same state of mind. So we have to take into account what stimulates and motivates us, not only in the formation of goals, but in listening to our biorhythms. Now, in Texas, it kind of sounds like it's easier to ride the horse in the direction it's going. But it's really about being attuned to what works best and what our own particular style and biorhythms are. Being grounded and centered allows a state of mind for optimum synthesis of thinking with access to existing knowledge. Anything stressful catapults someone into a state of mind that narrows concentration, limits the scope and range of thinking, and the stress hormones of epinephrine and cortisol actually block information processing. So, any thoughts or questions? A couple of more things I want to go over, but I want to be sure that this really makes sense for you.
This is great, Dave. I mean, it makes sense for me.
Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, it totally makes sense. And when you have that, you know, when you have an assistant that can control all of those distractions, I think it's wonderful. It's just, you know, when you have situations that you can't eliminate those distractions, very often that's where the modulation can, can be tested, you know. So, of course, that's the challenge, with your environment.
Yeah.
A couple of things that I do
is I don't plug my phone in until 9 o'clock in the morning because I protect that 6 to 9 time as creative time. That's when I'm doing things, developing programs, writing, doing a number of things. And I protect that time. I don't plug in. I carefully scan. I don't answer the doorbell. Since I've moved to totally a home office, I schedule people who come by, like yard people, pool people, anybody who comes by. They have a scheduled time. So I know, and I have on my reminder to unlock the gate at a particular time because I qualify the people who come for the ones who will stick to that schedule. And they don't bother me, and I don't bother them. So I think that when you have particular challenges like a home office, you have to really treat it in a structured way and respect that time and protect that time. And then you learn to do various things that support that and avoid things that distract. Any things that you find either challenging or best practices that you've learned?
Oh, no, I completely agree with you, totally. It makes a huge difference. And, of course, if you can find people that can stay on that schedule and be respectful, it's really terrific.
Uh-huh.
But I agree with you. It's very important to, and I really like that idea of, I mean, whether it's 6 to 9 or other blocks of time where, you know, once again, you just, what could be a distraction, you just really shut it off. Again,
uh-huh.
It's part of what I was saying before of, you know, it's important to go to technology and not be dragged around by it, which seems to be almost this new norm.
Yeah, like you were talking about initially about the pull, the magnetic pull of technology, so that you're running into stuff because you're so focused and in a state of mind that you're not aware of surroundings, but you're hyper-focused.
Oh, absolutely. I completely agree, and I think that, unfortunately, it just is this pill that people are swallowing that more, better, faster, and I completely agree with you, and I myself have made choices about how to deal with it, yet I don't think I'm really the norm anymore. I think that, just the opposite, and I'm, you know, I discuss it with other people, and very often they just really cannot understand why the whole world wouldn't want to have the latest, the best, the fastest, you know, it's kind of dark, but yes, I agree with you.
Yeah. Just a couple of other points, and then I want to look at more discussion. When you're relaxed and centered, you have the greatest access to all of your states of mind, all the information you possess. The antidote of purposeful relaxation can extend energy reserves and prompt fresh ideas. After a period of relaxation, attention and concentration improve. Psychobiologist Ernest Rossi suggests a 10 to 15 minute period of relaxation as a purposeful downtime to enhance performance and restore brain function. He reminds that these minutes are not about dozing or doing nothing, which would dull a mental edge, but active relaxation that keeps the mind primed. An example of active relaxation is a guided visualization accompanied by focused breathing. The visualization can be a relaxing moment, a scene in which mind, body, and soul are in harmony. Engaging all the senses in this image furthers the relaxation. If the image is to walk along the beach, this is in honor of Chris, engage the smell of the salty air, hear the surf, feel the sand between your toes, taste the air, experience the warmth of the sun on your skin. In other words, involve all the senses. These mental movies can lead to deep relaxation. As you end the relaxation, re-enter your surroundings calmly and slowly. Open your eyes, mildly contract body muscles, focus awareness on the present moment where you are. This is a quote from a Buddhist teaching, and listen to how the sense of grounding is literal as well as metaphorical. Return to the earth now if your mind is troubled and your heart is uncertain. For it is by returning to the beginning that we can clearly see the path. One other thing I wanted to mention is that I think is really interesting is pleasure and the hedonic treadmill. Our primal pleasure circuits can often override our seat of reason, the frontal cortex. You know, stocks, bargains can sometimes really take us off center in terms of responding. The principle that when it comes to money and investing, logic and intellect do not always prevail. Not only the anticipation of an exciting event, but the unpredictability of it adds to dopamine. Part of the thrill in winning and gambling is when positive outcome is a surprise and dopamine is released. Think about how, you know, when the brain predicts two things in a row, when the brain sees three things in a row, it predicts the third. Think about how gaming strategists have arranged for one cherry cluster and then two cherry clusters to pop up on the slot machine, and then the third is there, and it almost stops. But then it's one short or one extra, and nobody can walk away from that because, oh, man, I almost won. I'm going to do it again. the dopamine is firing at full force, and you're inclined to sustain that by continuing to play the slot machine. Here's a story that's an example of that. An original episode of the TV series, The Twilight Zone, involves a lifelong troublemaker and gambler, Rocky Valentine, who's killed after robbing a pawn shop. He awakens in the presence of an older gentleman in a white suit and tie who introduces himself as Pip and informs Rocky that he knows everything about him and that as his guide, he's devoted to giving Rocky everything he wants, whatever that might be. Rocky's dazzled by his wardrobe, cash, beautiful women, consistently winning and gambling, even though he keeps wondering what the catch is. After a month of these excesses, winning every time at every game, especially huge wins every time at his favorite, roulette, he finally becomes bored and restless. The thrill of winning at every hand has become stale. He's tired of women who dote on him. He tells Pip, "You know, I don't think I really belong in heaven. I don't fit here. I want to go to the other place." Pip replied, "Mr. Valentine, this is the other place." You know, the anticipation in gambling is interwoven with its unpredictability. This phenomenon of habituation contributes to the hedonic treadmill. Daniel Kahneman at Princeton, and this is one of the best books around on neuroscience, called Thinking Fast and Slow. Kahneman won a Nobel Prize, and this is his only book, and it came out like a couple of years ago, and I'd highly recommend it, Thinking Fast and Slow. And it really is about the two parts of the brain, the slow and the fast thinking parts of the brain. He coined the term the hedonic treadmill, in which the brain adapts to a state of wealth and possession and continually reach for newer sets of expensive expectations. So it's like the more you buy, the more you need to buy to keep going and to continue to try to get some kind of pleasure. So you're really on a treadmill, a hedonic treadmill, because you never get there, and you keep going, and you keep going faster and faster, because we believe that like certain possessions or certain achievements are going to provide happiness and ongoing satisfaction. But what we find is this is not true. In fact, Alain de Botton points out the fastest way to stop noticing something may be to buy it. And he adds, the fastest way to stop appreciating someone may be to become a colleague or to marry that person. We then have to imagine another achievement that will bring greater happiness. You know, same with a new car. So here are some steps to use the information of feelings and to master emotional triggers. Be aware of your feeling. And there's an exercise in the curriculum, a structured inquiry to recognize feelings. Because sometimes it's a challenge just to recognize feelings. Secondly, be aware of the emotional state that the feeling represents. Feelings always cue or trigger a state. Track your emotional state to be aware of the natural course of it. Specifically be aware of what triggers your emotional state. And ideally, the most common triggers of each of the emotional states that seem operative more so to you. Strategize a way to meet your needs. Be aware of your specific needs. Maybe even have a list of needs. And remember from the exercise of needs and ideals, your three major needs. Be aware and have a structured plan of meeting those needs on a regular basis. Because disregarding or not meeting a need will result in an emotional reaction. And if you have an emotional reaction you don't understand, write it down and work backward to see the need that was not met. Same with a client. An emotional reaction, the need that was not met. Strategize a way to meet that need in a better way. Let go of the impossible. And be clear about the fourth column. The new story, the ideal response. that you want, because that's the new story, the ideal response. Well, I wasn't watching the time enough. I kept going a little bit too long, so we don't have time for discussion. Does this make sense, and are there things that you would like us to pick up and discuss next time, for example?
I mean, to me, this makes perfect sense. I felt like I got this lesson.
Okay. All right. Great. Great. Anything else?
I love the examples, Dave. You know, I think when, you know, you use the examples about how still response benefits, you know, it creates much more of a...
Okay. All right. Great. Well, thanks. And remember, because of Thanksgiving, we won't meet next week, but we'll pick up 2 weeks from now. So you guys have a great Thanksgiving. I look forward to picking up with you. Thanks very, very much.
Thank you very much.
See ya.